This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Tim, you know, that one headline from the World Health Organization about Omicron won't be the last variant, but you do, you know, you're reminded that this thing's going to linger. Hopefully get easier, but linger.
Yeah, hopefully. Look, and we've talked to people about this, and we're going to talk more about this, but the idea of going from a pandemic to endemic and the idea that Omicron could be that, maybe. Look, here in New York City, the COVID-19 wave is slowing. Cases and hospitalizations are dropping dramatically from a peak in early January and remaining concentrated among those who are unvaccinated, Carol.
Right, but now we're hearing also about animals, South Africa, Hong Kong, like there's some concerns about that. All right, it's never a dull day when it comes to COVID. Hey, let's bring in our guest, Dr. Tom McGinn. He's Executive Vice President of Physician Enterprise over at Common Spirit Health. They've got more than 1,000 sites in some 21 states, I should say. They are a massive team, and they see a lot, and he's back with us on the phone in New York City. Dr. McGinn, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you, and what are you seeing?
Great to be back, and good to talk to you again. Well, I don't think we're seeing anything different than what you're currently saying. I do think as you go across the country, you can see the cases, particularly in the East Coast, as you've been stating here in New York and Maryland, New Jersey, the number of cases are obviously starting to turn down, which is good news. The tough news is obviously that hospitalizations are in other areas picking up as this virus, you know, moves across the country. So we have pockets in areas where we're seeing a little downturn, but we have pockets where we're probably at the beginning of this inflection. We think we're going to beat all our prior records in the original January phase, the Delta wave. We're going to definitely beat, in terms of hospitalizations, we're going to probably peak over all the prior quote unquote, you know, records, which is difficult with staffing right now. I think that's the combination that we're all struggling with. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not just the healthcare industry, but it puts it in sharp relief when, you know, the doctors who've been and nurses who've been doing this for close to 2 years are just under such strain that it's difficult to, you know, find a place in certain hospitals. Hey, Dr. McGinn, I'm wondering, because you have such a unique view of what's happening in different parts of the country and in more than 20 states, how would you characterize the people who are hospitalized right now? What can you tell us about who's hospitalized, who has been vaccinated and boosted versus who isn't?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, it's pretty well delineated. I mean, the numbers a little bit vary, but I would say anywhere from 60-80% of those admitted are unvaccinated, probably closer to 80%, and in some places 90%. And we do have, you know, some of this, we don't know the number. I think it's an interesting question of the incidental COVID, which is kind of a misleading term. So, example, if, you know, Mr. Smith, a young man, comes in with an ankle fracture and needs to be seen, they swab him, he's positive. So he's not there because of COVID, so he's incidentally diagnosed. We don't know what that number looks like. And that could be anywhere from a couple of percentage points, you know, maybe up to 10%. Now, you still have to isolate them, you still have to have protection. It's still very complicated to manage those patients, but in some ways they're not a traditional COVID case. So predominantly unvaccinated people are getting admitted to the hospitals. The remainder are going to be those with comorbidities, that, you know, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, et cetera.
Dr. McGinn, I do wonder, too, are you seeing cases where you guys and your teams and your emergency room staff are having to make decisions because there's just the systems are overloaded and you maybe can't have someone come in? Because maybe it's not because of COVID, but for some other reason, you just can't let them in because you just don't have the capacity.
You know, we haven't reached that point, thankfully. That is not something that's happening. The choices that we're currently facing, and again, this is very particular to, you know, different cities and different, you know, prevalences of the disease that's occurring, is whether we have to shut down other procedures that we do. Some of them, you know, are potentially life-saving. Maybe we have to have patients go to another site for certain things. Some of our hospitals have had to, you know, shift out of their elective procedures. Sometimes we've had to pull physicians or nurses or advanced care providers out of ambulatory sites to come in and help cover. So there is, an impact, but it's sort of an indirect impact. But no one is ever getting turned away in the sense that they could not get care. But we are pulling things away from other, resources, the elective procedures, for example. Not everywhere. I'm saying in small pockets that's happening.
What are you telling the world at large? I mean, Tim and I have had guests on who basically have said, you're all going to get this. I'm home because I've had a positive rapid and my PCR came back negative. I don't have any symptoms. I'm pretty sure it was, just a false positive. But nonetheless, we're being careful, which is the right thing to do. But it reminded me that if it's not now, it's probably just a matter of time. Is that the way we need to look at it?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, I would say we all just need to just really focus on doing all the smart things because of our hospitals and our healthcare workers and everyone involved in this. We need to do what we can to just stem the tide. I'm a little nervous with all the messaging, the waves are coming down and all to that effect. We need to continue to get vaccinated, boosted. We need to get the influenza shot, which is picking up across the United States. We're now seeing young children get admitted for influenza. And what we predicted over a year ago, the twindemic is happening now. And if we all don't get the flu shot, we're going to have, some struggle there. Will we all end up getting it? I don't think so. But, certainly a large percentage of us will have eventually gotten this. But to me, that's not the important question. The question is right now, what can we all do? Wear a cloth mask, by the way. No one should wear a cloth mask. Please stop the madness.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. And that's a good piece of advice. Dr. Tom McGinn over at Common Spirit Health, EV of Physician Enterprise. We appreciate his input. Joining us on the phone in New York City.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So, Tim, I think about, we worry about inflation, we worry about central banker policy missteps, we worry about slowing economic growth and earnings, and then you've got M&A, record year last year, and those big blockbuster transactions, they continue.
I thought you were going to say you worry about, large technology companies going at it alone.
Apparently not.
Yeah.
We need to worry.
We are, of course, talking about the huge news today, Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard, the game publisher, in a $69 billion game deal, if approved by regulators, a key, key phrase here, would create the third largest game publisher in the world.
So let's bring in Anurag Rana. He is Senior Analyst of Software and IT Services at Bloomberg Intelligence. He's on the phone from Chicago. Anurag, I heard you on Surveillance this morning, breaking this down as it was being or crossing. Are you surprised? Does this make sense?
Oh, it does make a lot of sense, but I was surprised at the same time, only because, as you said, this is not the season for large deals, just because the regulators are taking a look at this very closely, which is why the surprise is more so the size of it and the timing. But, the content side of it makes a lot of sense. And as I think I mentioned that in a couple of places before, we expected the gaming content wars to have begun many, many years ago, and it's just taken a long time for them to pan out.
So why does the content side make sense? Is it specifically for the Xbox platform and the, newest version of the cloud service that Xbox offers, the subscription service that it offers to people for $15 a month? Or is this about mobile? Is it about getting onto mobile devices and Microsoft finally being able to do that?
I think it's all of the above. Think about it the same thing, what's happening on the Netflix and the Disney arena. The company, the distribution channel or how you get the content is going to be, irrelevant later on, whether you see the movie on the phone or through any other means. But having the content is the most important part. So if you have the biggest gaming franchise, then whether you sell that through a virtual reality device or through, console, it doesn't matter.
Hey, Anurag, do regulators have an issue with this? Is that something that investors should be concerned about?
I think that's the biggest reason because, that's partially the reason I think with the stocks only at about 82 point something, I think that remains the biggest concern.
Anurag, one thing I'm curious about, Bobby Kotick of Activision, Microsoft and Activision, I think it's safe to say they're different kinds of companies. And I just do wonder, how much of what Activision is in terms of its culture, its types of management, it's crucial to keep it to some extent, or do you think it just doesn't matter? And depending, in terms of how much it gets integrated into Microsoft?
you know, that was the big question we had this morning as well. And although he was on the call this morning, we have since then read that once the deal is closed, he will not be part of the company. So I think that's a very good thing, because one of the things we had also said before was when this news broke of the Activision issues, Phil Spencer, Microsoft's gaming CEO, was very vocal and against it. So we were, you know, initially when the first deal broke out, we were surprised that he still remains with the company. But, you know, in subsequent releases, we have heard that he will leave.
All right. Yeah. So the question that I have is, what other gaming companies are in play now that if regulators approve this, and we see the stock reacting for competitors like EA and, you know, among others, Ubisoft, who's in play now? Just in about 30 seconds.
I think all of them are in play. I mean, it's going to be a question of, but the question is, who's going to buy them? I mean, is it going to be easier for Amazon or Apple or Facebook or Google to go out and buy some of these companies? I think it's going to be tougher for them. I think Microsoft has so far evaded the scrutiny of the regulators just because, you know, they don't have that level of, a lens on them as some of the other companies do.
All right. Well, we'll be certainly watching out for that aspect of this deal. Anurag, thank you so much. Good to catch up. Anurag Rana, he's senior analyst of software and IT services at Bloomberg Intelligence, on the phone from Chicago. But it's going to be a group that's on our radar this year, Tim.
Yeah, it certainly is. And Microsoft evading regulators, right? At least for the last, you know, couple decades. They have some history there.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, Bloomberg Business Week continuing to report on the real estate world and its lack of diversity and inclusion. And in the upcoming issue of the magazine, it's out later this week, a story about the progressive real estate firm Redfin that's facing accusations of discrimination. Tim, you can also find the story online.
The story's by Peter Robeson and Noah Buhayer. Peter Robeson is projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Seattle, as does Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the access line from Brooklyn. Joel, I think a lot of people in New York City, they know about the New York City Street Easy and the New York City specific services. And we've talked a lot about Zillow. For the uninitiated, Redfin, what is it?
Huge, huge provider. And basically, if you're anywhere else in the country, and New York included, you know, the chances are when you go to list your home, like Redfin could be a place that you consider. And one of the things that they've done is really had a mid-American offering, but as Peter and Noah's reporting goes into, there's still these vestiges that the real estate industry specifically kind of runs up against, and racial elements are continue to just be a really problematic one, and that is basically the subject of a lawsuit that Redfin's been involved with. So Peter, break it down for us. What are the two sides fighting over?
Sure. So Redfin, it appears to most people browsing on the web to be much like Zillow, that it's a place where you can get home listings and valuations. But Redfin is also a huge broker. It's the fifth largest real estate broker in the country. And Redfin has a very, very organized way of collecting leads of people who want to either list or their home or buy a home through Redfin. And they categorize these leads based on the value that sale or purchase is going to provide in each market, which they've used as a way to manage their workforce. They have a certain number of agents in each city. They're in certain parts of each city. So they argue that this is simply a way of organizing their business. The lawsuit brought by Fair Housing Groups toward the end of 2020. Pointed out that according to their studies, Redfin is much more likely to not provide its best service to homes that are in predominantly non-white neighborhoods. So that's what the fight is about. And Noah and I also talked to many current and former Redfin employees, and some of those people said that they had had concerns over the years about how much service Redfin is providing to minority neighborhoods.
So at issues, you do wonder, you know, Peter, in terms of, is it just a case of a company maximizing profit and they're, you know, organizing their organization to maximize the most out of their resources, or are they discriminating based on what you guys found out? And there's so much detail in the story. What's going on, or what are you seeing?
Redfin argues that that this is within their rights, that this is legally permitted, that they're applying a neutral basis, that price is a neutral basis to decide. But what the fair housing groups are arguing is that that's also a gating practice, that instead of taking each lead as they come in, they're assigning each lead based on value. And it is not resolved yet. The two sides say they have a framework for resolving this suit. It's partly going to come down to the data, and there's not agreement on the data between the two sides. The fair housing groups contend that the data shows that people in minority neighborhoods are less likely to get good service. Redfin claims that more recently, which is after the period of the suit, that their data is showing that they're not discriminating against people by race.
So, Peter, let's talk a little bit more about Redfin, because if you know anything about the company, some of these developments might come as something of a surprise, right?
Yes, that's a part of what really drew us to the story, because Redfin and its CEO, Glenn Kelman, have an extremely progressive reputation in the industry, and they've cultivated that. Glenn Kelman, well before George Floyd's murder, he hosted a symposium on race and real estate, and he's spoken out against unconscious bias. He's increased the training for unconscious bias after the Black Lives Matter protests. He created new rules to reward managers based on diversity in hiring. So that's partly what's so interesting about this suit, is that even a company that believes it's done everything right can run into issues. The opening example in the story was about a house on the south side of Chicago that's worth $187,000, which at the time we looked at, Redfin was not offering its best service. However, at the same time, a house in a predominantly white suburb of Glencoe, it was actually a condo, which is valued for $20,000 less, was being offered Redfin's best service. So that's the type of discrepancies and disparities that we looked at, and which are so alarming to these fair housing groups.
So if we step back from even that one, you know, Peter, the ultimate theme here, and you guys touched on this in some prior reporting as well, is basically minorities have been locked out of a lot of the wealth creation that real estate has afforded. So what, when you just step back and think about what all of your reporting on this topic means, like how are we getting anywhere better? Have there been any improvements?
There may be some improvements that come out of this suit. We had looked in the past at the Realtors Association, which apologized for, you know, made a formal public apology for decades of past racist behavior. There is more awareness in the industry, and that seems to be helping. And perhaps out of this, you know, one person that we talked to said that you know, redlining has been a part of the real estate industry, and we don't want to have redlining in the age of algorithms. So this is the moment to not let history repeat itself.
But it's a great point about here you've got a CEO who you feel like has been on it and doing the right thing, and then to see that, you know, there are problems there too. So it is just a reminder of how deep the problems are embedded in our system. Great story, and appreciate you spending some time with us. Bloomberg News P&I reporter Peter Robeson with us on the phone in Seattle, of course, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber on the Access line in Brooklyn. Catch that story. It'll be in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek on newsstands later this week. Find it online at Bloomberg.com and also on the Bloomberg terminal.
The opening anecdote here is really powerful. The idea that a more expensive apartment in a non-white area, you can't get the services that you get for a less expensive home in a predominantly white suburb.
I love, though, the series too, Tim, that, and I think Joel tapped into this. It's like so much of wealth creation is about property for Americans. And so if there's any kind of holding back on that, that's going to impact a family's ability, a minority family's ability to maybe create some wealth. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've talked about one of the biggest stories of the day. That is, of course, Microsoft buying Activision Blizzard in nearly a $69 billion all-cash deal. The other big one has, of course, to do with Goldman Sachs. We're in the midst of bank earnings right now, and we did hear from Goldman Sachs early in the day. Equity traders posting a decline in their fourth quarter. Revenue from the trading operation slid 7%, and equities business declined 11%, but compensation and benefits That is what we've all got our eyes on.
It does feel like, Tim, in a big way, we're getting a reset from the big banks. We heard it from the JP Morgan and the others last week, and I feel like we're getting more from Goldman.
Well, let's get a little bit of insight from Shanali Basak, Wall Street reporter for Bloomberg News. I checked when I was reading this morning what time Shanali got in, because I was like, okay, it's bank earnings week. It means she's getting in at 5 a.m. She's still here to hang out with us, and we're very grateful for that. Shanali, what do we need to know from Goldman Sachs? We've had a few hours to digest it.
Yeah, there's some sticker shock when it comes to how much compensation is rising on Wall Street. And when I spoke to the co-founder of Carlyle today, you know, what he really says is that this is defying gravity. But at the same time, you have this 33% jump in compensation expenses. That's the rise you saw in Goldman's revenue. And you saw that jump be bigger in percentage terms, more than double what you saw at J.P. Morgan, but J.P. Morgan's overall cost of compensation and benefits is much higher because they just have such a large workforce across the United States. So the thing I have to say to you guys that a lot of people are missing is it's not just compensation costs that are rising for the banks. There's technology costs and marketing costs. Pay is variable. If in a bad year, you don't get a big bonus. So that can change in a heartbeat next year.
Okay, I totally get it. But we heard the same similar things from Jamie Dimon last week when it came to pay, right? And the other part of this, Shanali, that I'm wondering is, doesn't this also in the long run, when you pay to actually keep and retain employees, doesn't that actually, I don't want to say even out, but it ends up being a good thing in the long run because it's really expensive to lose people.
It's expensive to lose people, and actually that was part of the cost. If you talk to JP Morgan, their CFO actually said that attrition was part of that compensation cost. So yes, it's absolutely expensive to lose people. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to market share. If they are winning on the top line, then it's okay to pay people as long as they are winning on the top line, rewarding investors, all of the above. So what really kind of spooked people today is that some of these booming businesses the last couple of years are going to start to moderate. Equity trading revenue, it came in 11% lower, and that's for a firm that is actually, it had done better than Goldman, it did better than J.P. Morgan. It brought in more revenue in stock trading than J.P. Morgan. So tomorrow for Morgan Stanley, which is also experiencing a severe stock decline today, the bar is very high for that stock trading business, because if that revenue also starts to come down, and more importantly, if they don't beat Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley has been the number one stock trading firm for years. It's a problem, because then you're paying people and you're not necessarily getting the market share as well.
So, Shanali, what's happening? Is it increased competition from fintech? Like, I'm trying to understand the businesses where they're maybe seeing some numbers not as upbeat as that they've been. What's going on? Is it just greater competition, alternatives out there for the big banks, or what's going on?
There's a few things going on. One is that competition. If you think about it, if you're a trader, what is the calculus you're making? Yes, working for a tech firm, a crypto firm, whatever, but really, or working for a hedge fund. And if you work for a hedge fund or private equity firm, they're typically smaller than a big bank that has capital requirements, it has regulatory things to deal with, it has many more people to pay. But if you work for a smaller firm, you're not giving all that money back to a big bank. You're keeping more of it for yourself. So, you know, if in a couple weeks the boutique banks are going to report earnings, and we already know from early indications that some of those compensation jumps are well above what we see at Goldman Sachs.
Interesting. So, okay, so we've had a handful of the banks report. What are we learning about? Not just the state of banks, which we've talked about, but the state of the economy, because they give us an insight into how the consumer is and how healthy the consumer is. How's the American consumer? What have we learned?
It's a really interesting question, because we don't see credit rising as quickly as we would expect. Then you throw in some other questions about interest rates that nobody seems to want to answer. Are you going to take out a mortgage at a higher interest rate? And so it's a complicated question, but we haven't gotten clear answers from bankers about that. They say that the economy is healthy, but then investors equally say, you know, and we were talking about David Rubenstein today, the Carlyle co-founder, that a correction is also possible. You look at Mohamed Alarian too, and he also asked a question in Bloomberg Opinion column today, at what point do the Fed policies start to catch up with financial conditions and financial conditions start tightening? What you're hearing there from investors is anywhere between tighter conditions and negative conditions.
Yeah, And that is certainly going to be something that the big banks will be watching, and certainly watching for some kind of impact. Shanali, thank you so much. We know it's been a long day, but we really appreciate your input. I always appreciate her notes that she sends out in the morning. That gives me instant analysis about all of these financial firms and their reporting.
Hey, we're not done, by the way. Bank of America, mm-hmm. Manana, Morgan Stanley as well.
Yeah, some big ones, right?
Yeah.
And we'll look for what they have to say, whether it mirrors what we've been hearing. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, let's get to it. We've got just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session, and we've once again seen selling pressure on Wall Street, in particular among those tech names, as we heard from Charlie. You've got the NASDAQ down about 2.4%. So, Tim, let's get to our market guest.
Yeah, there's kind of nowhere to hide. Even, you know, the major industry groups right now, energy is higher, but barely, with financials leading the decliners, down more than 2.3%. Marcy McGregor is Senior Investment Strategist at Bank of America Private Bank. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Marcy, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, help us understand just how we should and how our audience should think of a day like today. Abigail Doolittle from Bloomberg Markets earlier in the day shared with us this pretty mind-boggling stat that the NASDAQ right now is on pace for its worst month since March of 2020. And right now, as a month, it's down about 7.1%. And March of 2020, it finished the month down 10.1%. So we're not even off of it. It's not looking like a good month so far.
Yeah, and we've been saying, I think, for 2022, it's a year where we're going to have volatility, especially around the Fed, right? All anyone wants to talk about is the Fed and inflation. And it's going to feel like a bit of a grind, even though we think ultimately equities move higher from here. But the pain we're seeing, I think, is in those big growth non-earners. And that's likely to continue. But the big story, of course, is Fed rate hikes. And believe it or not, energy and tech, we prefer kind of mega tech, big, more defensive tech, but those are the two sectors that actually lead 3 months into rate hikes and then in the 3 to 6 months after. So I think it's a market searching for leadership. Ultimately, I think energy and financials win that battle, but that's not quite what we're seeing today.
Well, and let's not forget, I mean, we still will have, at this point, economic growth. We will still have earnings growth, just not the blockbuster numbers that we've seen, Marcy, right, in the past year.
I totally agree. I think what the market cares about is peak earnings, not peak earnings growth. And I don't think peak earnings is a 2022 story, may not even be a 23 story, because I think strong nominal GDP growth, which we certainly have, is going to continue to be a tailwind for corporate profits this year.
Is there concern, though, that, and this is something Tim and I have talked a lot about, the magazine, Business Week magazine has covered it a lot, about a policy misstep by the U.S. Central Bank, other central banks that have an impact on global economic growth and maybe redirect our thinking when it comes to the opportunities this year?
It's absolutely a risk. And if you think about 2 months ago, I would have shared that I thought the Fed was getting further and further behind the curve. Now I see that risk as being more balanced in terms of a dovish and a hawkish risk. The Fed seems to be getting more serious about taking a bite out of inflation, but now you have global monetary policy diverging. So I do think we have to acknowledge that inflation is certainly sticky. That raises the pressure on the Fed. We're seeing a slowdown in growth, I think, because of Omicron right now. That seems to move in two-month waves around the world. But you have a Fed with persistent price pressure. They need to address it. I think the risk is they could kind of overcorrect, but I think that's not where we are today. But we have to acknowledge it's a risk for sure.
What does an overcorrection look like?
You know, I think what the market is anticipating right now is the first rate hike in March, and we get four this year. But we have to remember there's six FOMC meetings after March. So every month the market is going to be parsing every single word and looking for a policy adjustment. I think the risk is that the Fed doesn't communicate well. So far, I have to say Powell and Fed leadership has done a really good job. You know, while the market is volatile, we're not seeing an overreaction to what is a pretty stunning pivot from the Fed. So I think the biggest risk right now is miscommunication, but so far I have to give the Fed good grades on that.
Having said that, you know, Marcy, there's a lot of talk at this point about the Fed is maybe way behind the curve. Dr. Henry Kaufman, the original Dr. Doom, sitting down with our Eric Schatzker, we talked about it on Friday, and the concern is, you know, that maybe this Fed doesn't have the nerve or the comfort to do something like a Paul Volcker did that was very unpopular or seemingly to raise rates in a high inflationary environment, but it was the right thing to do. Are there conversations that you guys are having at your firm about that?
So I think what we all have to get acclimated to is less the pain of a Fed policy error, and maybe the idea that the correct policy to really take a bite out of inflation in itself could be painful. And I think with a market expecting a rate hike in March, I do think the Fed will move ahead with that. It seems to be short-sighted if they didn't, since the market's already acclimated to that view. So I think they're going to move ahead. I mean, we saw in the most recent FOMC minutes, they're already talking about quantitative tightening. That took 2 years last time from the first Fed rate hike, and we think you get the first step towards QT later this year. So the Fed's moving in the right direction, but the correct policy may be painful itself and could potentially cause a mid-cycle slowdown. We don't see the recession risk, and we don't see it in the curve either. The curve's kind of treading water right now. If it stays that way, I think it's telling us that they're not overly, the market's not overly concerned about a policy error, but the correct dose of policy may itself be painful.
Okay, so a handful of earnings coming up this week, Marcy, just in the last minute that we have with you, includes Alcoa, United Airlines, Intuitive Surgical, Netflix, Bank of America, United Health Group, just to name a few. What should we be looking for? I mean, I'm thinking pricing pressure, right? I'm thinking wage pressure. What are you going to be looking for?
It's all about wage pressure this week, and real wages have not kept up with inflation, and real wages haven't kept up with corporate profits. That's why we've seen companies protect their margins so effectively. I think if we look out to next week, you're going to see more cyclical industries join the earnings party. I think the cyclicals this quarter are likely to report revenue above the average S&P level, so I think that's going to be a positive story. But it's all about wage pressure. That's going to be a story all year, I think, and looking at companies that can pass through those higher prices to a strong consumer.
Right. Higher wages, but then, right, you got to put that against inflation and how much does that eat into those wage increases. Hey, Marcy, thank you so much. Marcy McGregor, she's Senior Investment Strategist at Bank of America Private Bank. Tim, on the phone in New York City.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.